Blog Talk Radio.
Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio is on the air. From Los Angeles, I'm Royal Oaks of ABC News and the law firm of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, inviting you to join us for Hinshaw Law Radio. This program features prominent lawyers and insurance industry professionals discussing insurance and reinsurance cases, issues, and developments. Before we get started, a reminder that the information on Insurance Law Radio is provided for general information purposes only. Nothing stated in the program constitutes legal advice or creates any attorney-client relationship. You should consult directly with an attorney of your choosing if you wish to obtain any advice with respect to any claim or matter. Any views expressed are those of the guests and are not necessarily the views of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, or any of its clients. And now we go to Chicago and your host for Insurance Law Radio, the co-chair of Hinshaw & Culbertson's National Insurance Services Practice Group, Scott Seaman.
Thank you, Royal Oaks, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We hope that all of our wonderful listeners are having an enjoyable holiday season, and as we embark upon a new year in the world of insurance coverage, we thought it would be a good time to look key insurance coverage rulings from 2016 and look ahead to some of the cases to watch in 2017. We all do our best to keep current on case law developments. We turn to various sources, and one of the best resources is insurance law from Law 360. In fact, I look at Law 360 every weekday morning at exactly 3:44 a.m. Central Time. That's when the email comes across with the update from Law 360. So we thought the best place to turn for this show on key insurance coverage cases is Law 360, and we're pleased to welcome our special guest, Jeff Sinstrunk. Jeff is the senior insurance reporter at Law 360. He has reported on insurance law and regulation at Law 360 for the past 2 years. He graduated with a journalism degree from the University of Arkansas and previously worked for daily newspapers both in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And Jeff is someone who obviously stays on top of the insurance coverage world, and he enlightens insurers, policyholders, practitioners, and courts alike on insurance cases throughout the year. Welcome, Jeff, and thank you for joining us on Insurance Law Radio.
And thanks for having me.
Well, you know, we all turn to you and to Law 360 to keep us current on cases and other developments. As the senior insurance reporter at Law 360, how do you stay on top of events? What do you some of the sources and resources you look to?
Well, it comes down to a few things. One thing that we have over here is a sophisticated system that pulls in documents from PACER, the federal court dockets, and synthesizes them into something that we can easily sift through to find insurance-related litigation developments. And then on top of that, I've got upwards of about 50 bookmarks on my computer for all the major state appeals courts, and keep an eye on those as well. And at any given time, I maintain a list of anywhere from 30 to 50 major cases that are out there, and regularly check in on those every week. And then on top of that, I've got my base of sources, got about 70 sources on both the policyholder and insurer side of the bar, and check in with them periodically just to get a sense of what they're keeping an eye on and what issues have been, a major source of focus for them. So it's a multi, front approach there, but, I like to think it keeps us on top of all the most recent developments.
Well, it does that, and of course, I know some of your sources, and source is a nice word in those cases for attorneys that represent insurers and policyholders that know of you and reach out to you when they receive a decision in their case. So you really have all of your antennas out there focusing on developments of interest, right?
Yeah, and it's, you know, I mean, I can't emphasize enough how important it is, you know, to have attorneys that keep me updated, you know, on what's going on in their cases. And there's been some developments over the past year that I wouldn't have, you know, gotten a pulse on, you know, for a day or two if it weren't for sources, you know, giving me a call the second they get the decision in their inbox, you know, to keep me up to date.
Sure. And Jeff has written a couple of articles recently for Law 360 that are going to give us the subject matter for our broadcast today. One is on top insurance decisions in 2016, and the other is on cases to watch in 2017. And I may add a couple to each of the lists, Jeff, just to kind of throw you off a little bit. But before we delve into those cases, let us know a little bit of the methodology and the process that you use to make your selections of the key cases.
Sure. Well, what I've done this year and in the past couple of years is send out surveys to just a random selection of sources. And this year I had, I think, 30 to 35 sources that provided feedback. And from those, I culled through those cases that were mentioned both as major, you know, the most major decisions of 2016, and then the biggest cases to watch in 2017, and had the unenviable task of narrowing those down to five apiece. I think on both of them, I wound up with 20 or more cases, and I think on the biggest decisions, there was something like 27 different cases that came up. So I compared my notes to the results that I got from those surveys, and then just looked more broadly at the cases that drew the most attention on sources like JD Supra and other aggregators of law firm blogs. And finally, after a much wringing of hands and you know, last minute you know, research, I was able to narrow both lists down.
Well, and I have to say, very impressive list, and I agree with all the cases that are on there. But topping your list, we'll start first with the key decisions of 2016, and topping your list is the New York Court of Appeals decision from May in the Viking Pump case. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that case and why that topped your list?
Sure. So this is a decision that made waves throughout the entire industry and was unanimous number one on almost every survey that I sent out. And here the New York Court of Appeals broke with precedent implementing pro rata allocation for long-term injury under liability policies, and that line of decisions goes you know, back to and includes the 2002 decision in the Con Ed case. And here the Court of Appeals held that where there's a non-cumulation clause, that those sorts of clauses conflict with pro rata allocation, and that in those circumstances, an all sums approach, you know, under which all the policies in a single year, you know, can be held liable for an entire loss, can apply if you've got a non-cumulation or non-cum clause present. And so that was a big decision from the policyholder's perspective, and a lot of the feedback I got at the time, you know, was that this would provide you know, an easier path to recovery, allowing policyholders to consolidate coverage in their insurance tower in a single year. as opposed to litigating against multiple carriers. And then on the flip side of that, the insurer side bar expressed concern over more extensive litigation, for contribution actions and having to go after all the other carriers that whose policies were triggered for long tail losses and seek their shares for the loss. So yeah, overall it was the biggest decision of the year by a lot of measures, and I think it's by far the one decision that I've seen cited the most times since. So I think we're going to continue to see these issues play out as the impact of this decision continues to be felt going into 2017 and beyond.
I think you're exactly right, Jeff. And a lot of folks say, well, before this case, New York was very clear. It was a pro rata allocation jurisdiction. After this case, I think the takeaway is New York is a presumptively pro rata jurisdiction, subject to any policy language, and here specifically non-accumulation provisions that would require a different result. And from the standpoint of the New York Court of Appeals, we've seen that in other cases and other issues, including number of occurrences, where the court places a lot of reliance and looks closely at contract language. But even coming out of this decision, the court still leans pro rata, and it cited its Consolidated Edison decision that you alluded to earlier with approval. And again, absent language like the non-cum clause here, it would be pro rata. I have to say, though, it's a significant decision because a lot of insurance coverage programs do have policies with non-accumulation clauses, so it's not that rare. And the main issue, I think, or the, whenever you resolve some issue like this and you make some changes to law, you say, well, what's the next issue? It's pretty clear if you've got no non-cum clauses, you prorate. It's also pretty clear that if you have a non-cum clause, now the policyholder can spike. But what if you've got an insurance program with some policies that contain or follow form to non-cum clauses and others that do not? And I think that's the open issue of how do you handle that in the wake of Viking Pump. The other thing I have to say, Jeff, is you're right. I mean, policyholders were jumping up and down and lauding this decision as driving a spike in New York pro rata allocation law, pun intended on that. And insurers generally have not really welcomed the decision. Some view it as using a clause that was intended to limit insurer exposure to expand it. And as we alluded to earlier, it doesn't inject some uncertainty into New York law. And many of the insurers, and they argued this in the case, felt that the Olin 3 decision of the Second Circuit did a better job of reconciling the non-cum clause with the pro rata allocation. But, of course, the New York Court of Appeals gets the final word on that. The other thing I'd like your take on is this is not the first decision that has found inconsistencies between a non-accumulation clause and a pro rata allocation. But the courts have done different things with it. You know, for example, in Viking Pump, the court said, okay, that's going to support us going to an all-sums allocation. The Massachusetts Court of Appeals decision and Chicago Bridge and Iron did the same thing. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court in 2009 went the same way in Riley. But there have been other cases that recognize the inconsistency and therefore refuse to enforce the non-cum clause as running counter to the state's pro rata allocation methodology. And a couple of cases that went that way were the Spalding Composites case from the New Jersey Supreme Court in 2003 and the Outboard Marine decision from an Illinois appellate court in 1996. So the other thing I would say is there was another Viking court decision rendered by another Supreme Court, the Supreme Court in Delaware, which had certified the allocation and exhaustion issue to the New York Court of Appeals. After that was decided, the Delaware Supreme Court, and I know you reported on this, issued a another decision that addressed such issues as trigger of coverage, going with New York's injury in fact trigger, treatment of defense costs under a variety of excess forms, and under an umbrella form, and also addressed the issue of assignment of rights. And that decision did not make your list, and I happen to agree. I don't think there's anything special or terrific about that case that warrants making your top five. But you do have to admit, Jeff, that it's rare that a single coverage case produces decisions from two different state Supreme Courts.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's interesting you say that because I went back to some of the sources that I talked to, you know, and sent surveys to and asked them about the Delaware case. And really, yeah, I mean, it was the case that once the New York Court of Appeals answered the certified questions and sent the case back over to Delaware, the resulting decision was very fact-specific. You know, there were a couple of, you know, broader takeaways on, you know, on trigger and the like, but as a whole, you know, the mantra with that decision out of Delaware was that it was, you know, it was very driven by the facts. You know, in this case, there were a lot of, you know, really long-winded disputes that went on before the lower court, and you know, so arguably it's, some of the circumstances here would be hard to replicate, you know, to a T in another case, which is why I think that decision, you know, was received less attention, you know, because once the Court of Appeals answers to the certified questions were applied, the rest of the analysis was driven by the facts.
Yeah, and no unusual legal pronouncements, although I did disagree with the court's decision on the umbrella policy because the not covered language it relied upon to say that defense costs were owed has been held really throughout the country is dealing with the type of coverage provided, the scope of coverage, and not exhaustion. But so let's move on to the second case on your list, the August decision of the New Jersey Supreme Court in Cypress Point Condominium Association.
Sure.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that one and why it was significant?
Sounds good. So, yeah, so with Cypress Point, you had the New Jersey Supreme Court weighing in on a question that has come up very frequently in my time on this beat, which is whether the consequential damages from a subcontractor's faulty work can constitute property damage and an occurrence or accident triggering an insurance company's duty to defend. And so here the Supreme Court came down on the policyholder's side and said that damages to the common areas of condominium complex over in Hoboken could, you know, constitute an occurrence because they, you know, they stemmed not from the faulty work itself, you know, but rather were, I guess it would be more accurate to say they weren't, you know, the subcontractor's faulty work itself, but rather damage to other property. And so in making this ruling, the New Jersey Supreme Court came down on the same side of the issue as I think at last count I had it at more than two dozen other state Supreme Courts, and then by contrast, you have five state Supreme Courts who have ruled that these sorts of consequential damages aren't covered under CGL policies. So the from the policyholder bar's perspective, you know, this they said this provided more certainty for construction policyholders in New Jersey. But one thing that is still left open by this decision, you know, and really by decisions in any of the state Supreme Courts that have decided it, is the application of various other exclusions. So this isn't necessarily, you know, opening the door to coverage in every instance for consequential damages from faulty work. In fact, in this case, on a remand to the New Jersey trial court, last week, the trial court released Crum and Forrester from the case and said that an exclusion for damage that incepted prior to the policy period and that continued on through the policy period was still excluded from coverage. So it's it was an impactful decision in that it answered this question, you know, that's come up repeatedly, you know, on these construction defect cases. But at the same time, I mean, you still have a lot of issues in play in these cases when it comes to exclusions and other factors. So it was, an interesting case that, you know, is going to continue to yield a lot of, you know, additional disputes going forward.
And as you say, though, it does clear one bar for the policyholders, but a bar that has been cleared in the majority of cases to address the issue. The third case on your key decision list is the recent decision, I think this month, from the Florida Supreme Court in SIBO versus American Home Assurance Company, resolving a conflict among Florida appellate court districts, correct?
That's right. Yeah, and so this was a long pending case. It was argued back in September of 2015, and as you said, decided on the first of the month in December, and it resolved a split between the Third District Court of Appeal, which established a concurrent causation standard for evaluating coverage in first-party property cases. And that case was called Wallach versus Rosenberg. And then you had the decision below in this case from the Second District Court of Appeal that rejected the reasoning in Wallach and said, no, in cases where you have multiple causes of loss and one of them is covered, you still have to look to what the primary and or efficient cause of the loss was, and if that cause is excluded, then the whole loss is excluded. So what the Florida Supreme Court did here was looked at the facts of the underlying case. So you had a resident of Naples with a large home, I guess you could call it a mansion, and there were multiple incidents that caused the loss. You know, first you had faulty workmanship, and defective construction that left the house vulnerable to leaking like a sieve, as it turned out. And then there were summer rains, and then finally you had hurricane-related damage. And so the Supreme Court looked at the facts of this case and said that it was impossible to separate out what the efficient cause of the loss here was, because you had construction defects, you had rain damage.
Construction defects would have been excluded and the
right
and rain and wind would be covered.
Exactly. And so the so the court said, you know, in cases like this where it's just you know, it wouldn't be feasible to single out one cause as being the primary cause, that the concurrent causation doctrine applies. At the same time, though, it left the door open for the application of the efficient proximate cause doctrine in cases where you can trace back the loss to a single cause, you know, and if that cause, you know, was excluded and set in motion a chain of events resulting in the loss, the efficient proximate cause doctrine can still be applied. Of course, what that'll mean in practice is that there will likely continue to be disputes over causation, and a lot of expert testimony and written analysis as to what the causes of loss were. Sort of in the, you know, in the same vein as the first two decisions we talked about, you know, the Florida Supreme Court here answered one question, but left the open, you know, a number of other questions, and you know, I think I would expect to see expert disputes on causation continue in Florida going forward.
Yeah, so I mean, ostensibly a policyholder victory, but that caveat still leaves the door open for insurers in particular cases to make their arguments, and still an important case for the policyholders, and particularly given the jurisdiction of Florida, where we see a lot of these types of cases and issues arise.
Exactly.
So moving on to case number four, the April decision of the Colorado Supreme Court in Strescon Corp. versus Travelers. And Jeff, for some reason, I feel like Casey Kasem operating in reverse here with this list, but go ahead and tell us about this decision.
Sure. So in this case, you had a sharply divided Colorado Supreme Court. The final decision was 4-3, ruling that policyholders that settle claims that arise prior to suit without the insurance carrier's permission are not entitled to coverage. And the key issue here, and what the policyholder in this case had requested, was that the Supreme Court expand Colorado's notice prejudice rule, which of course requires an insurer to show that it suffered prejudice from late notice of a claim before it can deny coverage. And so here, the Intermediate Appeals Court below had gone in the policyholder's favor and said that Colorado's notice prejudice rule should be extended to cases where policyholders violate clauses, you know, found in liability policies that bar them from voluntarily settling claims or making payments without the carrier's consent. But the majority of the Colorado Supreme Court rejected that notion and said that the notice prejudice rule doesn't apply to these no voluntary payments provisions. The core of their reasoning was that an insurer's denial of coverage due to the policyholder's failure to comply with the no voluntary payment provision was not just a technicality. So in other words, the court said that by going and settling the claim without the carrier's consent, you know, that wasn't just just an afterthought, you know, as far as the policy is concerned, and the policyholder has to be held responsible, you know, for deliberately violating that provision. And you know, from the insurance industry's perspective, this was a very favorable decision. One source told me that the decision affirms the notion that an insurance policy isn't just a bank, that extends coverage, and pays losses regardless of the circumstances, behind the claim and the resolution of the claim. So it was a win for the insurance industry and and insurance carriers, and affirmed the notion that's advanced by a lot of courts that there are a number of conditions in a policy that must be complied with and can't just be cast aside.
Well, that's exactly right. Obviously, there was a provision of the policy prohibiting voluntary payments, which is common. And as we used to say, if that provision isn't enforced, it gives the policyholder carte blanche to settle claims with the insurer's money and without the insurer's ability to do anything except try and challenge it after the fact, sometimes under difficult standards. So the decision was a correct one. And by the way, I say carte blanche, nobody probably knows what that is anymore, so I would say a debit card now. But 6-3-4 insurers and a correct decision. And rounding out your list of key decisions is an absolutely beautiful decision from the Bayou, from the Louisiana Supreme Court in the Amstar case. Why don't you talk to us about that case a little bit?
Sure. So continuing with the string of allocation decisions, so in September, the Louisiana Supreme Court adopted a pro rata allocation approach in a CNA Financial Corporation insurer's dispute with a company called American Sugar Refining Incorporated, and the dispute was over defense coverage for claims brought by employees who alleged that they suffered hearing loss at one of the policyholder's refineries. So in this case, kind of going with one of the mantras, arose after the Viking Pump decision. A lot of attorneys and industry insiders, said that Viking Pump affirms that New York is a policy language state, and the same notion applies here. Where you had the Louisiana Supreme Court looking to the policy and giving effect to all of the terms of the policy in making their decision to reverse the lower court here and determine that, the lower court had determined that the CNA Financial unit, Continental Casualty Company, had to pay for 100% of American Sugar Refining's defense costs for the underlying actions. But the Louisiana Supreme Court said that the lower court's finding, that Continental could be held liable for the entirety of the defense expenses was contrary to the language of the relevant policies, which said that the insurer is required to cover bodily injury occurring during the policy period. And in this case, Continental only had policies without employment claim exclusions in effect for 26 months out of the 65-year period that was cited by the underlying plaintiffs. The way that this this decision came down and the rationale followed by the court here stands for the proposition that first and foremost the policy language is key in determining the scope of the carrier's obligations, and the policyholder here brought in public policy considerations and notions of fairness and the like, but the Louisiana High Court said that before you can take any of those arguments into consideration, you have to look at the policy language, and they said that the policy language here did not support being held liable for the entire loss.
Well, that's exactly right. And the language here, the during the policy period language, is common. That's the language most courts rely on when coming up with prorated decisions. And in fact, the New York Court of Appeals relied on that language in Consolidated Edison and reiterated in Viking Pump that it, but for the non-accumulation clause, the that limitation would be given effect and it would be a prorate allocation. And of course, then you get into the fairness arguments, and it's, the court kind of rejected that by, as you pointed out, saying, well, it's really unfair to hold an insurer responsible when it's on the risk for 26 months out of 65 years, and when it's got this express language in the contract. So a good decision. It also dealt with defense costs, and the policyholder tried to emphasize the breadth of the duty to defend and how that's broader than the duty to indemnify, and the court shot that down, saying regardless of duty to defend or duty to indemnify, it's got to be something covered, and it can't be something that's not within the language of the policy. So great decision for the insurers, positive judicial contribution to the world. And Jeff, as I indicated, I think all the cases on your list, all these top five, are excellent. And I'm just going to suggest a couple of runners-up.
Sounds good.
The first is one I know you know about, the New Jersey Supreme Court decision in Tempo Fuente DeVita Corp. I'm sure I pronounced that brilliantly. Simple decision. The Supreme Court ruled that National Union, the insurer, did not have to demonstrate it was prejudiced by the policyholder's late notice of a lawsuit under a claims-made policy. It was a unanimous decision. It, you know, is straightforward. It recognizes requirements to trigger a claims-made policy, and they weren't satisfied, period, end of story. It's hardly a novel ruling, but for some reason, a lot of policyholder friends of mine, lawyers in New Jersey, were thinking, or at least hoping, that the New Jersey High Court would apply the notice prejudice rule that applied to occurrence-based policies on the issue of late notice. It didn't happen. It shouldn't happen. Good decision. Clearly not one of the top five, but I think it merits some discussion.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I agree it helped clear up, you know, any confusion about how, you know, the notice requirements apply in New Jersey. And, you know, and yeah, the policyholder bar in New Jersey, you know, was definitely holding out hope that the New Jersey Supreme Court would go the other way. But again, you know, going back to the policy language, you know, the Supreme Court looked at this case, said the insured didn't provide notice as soon as practicable, and that was the end of the story. So it's I feel like there's a theme emerging here, you know, perhaps even more so than the individual issues, you know, policy language being you know, the biggest factor in all these cases.
So Jeff, I'm going to throw one more your way, which is the it's a New York Appellate Division First Department decision in Keyspan Gas versus Munich Re America. And I think it's a significant decision for two reasons. First, the court applied a pro-rata allocation under New York law, and this was a decision that came down after Viking Pump. There were no non-accumulation clauses, and the case really confirms what we had said earlier about New York remaining a presumptive pro-rata allocation jurisdiction. But more importantly, the court rejected the so-called unavailability of insurance exception to the general requirement in a pro rata jurisdiction that a policyholder bears responsibility for all uninsured or self-insured periods. And we know that the vast majority of pro rata jurisdictions do not recognize any unavailability of insurance exception. and this exception that policyholders have been trying to push forward across the country and has not caught on very far has its genesis in some language from the New Jersey Supreme Court decision in Owens, Illinois. So you see some courts in New Jersey, and we have seen some federal courts, but not all in New York, are purporting to apply New York law that have held policyholders are not responsible for uninsured periods when insurance for the type of risk at issue was not available for purchase. And this is the very first New York State appellate decision to address the unavailability of insurance issue, and the court held there is no such exception under New York law. Decision is solid. And so, ladies and gentlemen, there you have the year in review for 2016 key insurance coverage decisions. Very well done, Jeff. And on the other side, we'll come back and talk about the key cases to watch in 2017 on Hinshaw's Insurance Law Radio.
You're listening to Hinshaw & Culbertson LLP's Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Let's return to the program and your host, Scott Seaman.
We are back, and Jeff, it's time for us to look forward and turn to your list of key cases to watch in 2017. And the first one on your hit list is Vankowski versus Washington National Insurance Company, which is before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. It's a bad faith case.
Yeah, and this is the type of case that we love over here at Law 360, a case that stands to clarify precedent on a major coverage issue. So here you've got the Pennsylvania Supreme Court looking at the proper standard for bad faith under state law, and the crux of the case is whether state appeals court's 1994 ruling in this case called Terletzky versus Prudential definitively established a method for determining an insurer's bad faith, and if so, whether the appellate court in this case, the Rankowski case, erred in holding that an insurer's motive of self-interest or ill will is merely a discretionary consideration, or if it is a mandatory prerequisite to proving bad faith. So there's a little bit to break down there. So I'll start back with the Terletzky decision. So in that case, the appellate court, known as the Superior Court in Pennsylvania, ruled that under state law, an insurer's bad faith can be established when the insured demonstrates that the insurer lacked a reasonable basis for denying benefits under the policy and knew or recklessly disregarded its lack of a reasonable basis in denying the claim. And in the Rankowski case, which dealt with cancer patients' bid for coverage under the policy with Washington National, the appellate court had ordered a new trial and found that dishonest purpose or motive of self-interest or ill will is not a third element required for finding of bad faith under Pennsylvania law, but it can be considered in determining whether there was bad faith. So this is another case that's attracted a lot of attention from both sides of the insurance bar. There's a lot of concern.
And this is going to be the first time that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court will weigh in on the standard.
It will be. Yeah, so they'll be looking at that Terletzky standard and deciding for the first time, whether that standard, requires showing of a self-interested motive, as a prerequisite for bad faith. For both policyholder and insurer side practitioners in Pennsylvania, this stands to provide a lot of clarity. In speaking with sources, I've heard that they're for the past two decades has been a great deal of confusion over how the Terlecki standard is applied, and so this gives the Pennsylvania Supreme Court the opportunity to shed light on that question. And you know, there's a lot of concern on the insurer side that if the Supreme Court decides that a motive of self-interest or ill will is not a mandatory requirement, that could open up insurance companies to more bad faith actions and lower the bar for policyholders to clear. But it's going to be interesting to see how the Pennsylvania Supreme Court comes down on these issues.
Yes, and sort of in a obviously very related question for you, what is your favorite NBA team?
Well, it's this is the kind of thing that would get me beat up around here in L.A., but the Houston Rockets are my team. I grew up in the Houston area, and I, you know, got to, you know, stick to my allegiance, you know, despite all of the...
I'm a Bulls fan, of course. So why the hell would a Rockets fan and a Bulls fan want to talk about the second case on your list, the Los Angeles Lakers versus Federal Insurance Company before the Ninth Circuit?
Well, I guess sometimes I've just got to put aside my bias, especially where the Telephone Consumer Protection Act and you know, issues are involved. So segueing into this case, so the Lakers are in an insurance coverage battle with their D&O insurer, Federal Insurance Company, and the so just by way of background, so the Lakers had been sued by a fan named David Emanuel, who said that he had received unsolicited text messages from the team with various promotions. And so the case eventually settled, and the Lakers sought coverage from Federal for the losses. And so the lower court here, California District Judge, decided that an exclusion for various sorts of claims, including invasion of privacy claims, applied to bar coverage. And so now on the on appeal to the Ninth Circuit, the Lakers are arguing that the underlying TCPA suit did not solely allege claims for invasion of privacy. So the core issue here, you know, and one that I imagine would come up in a lot of TCPA cases, you know, particularly in jurisdictions where TCPA litigation is very prevalent. I mean, both California and Illinois, you know, are have seen a huge influx of these cases. Yeah, and so the issue that this case turns on is whether the TCPA is solely, you know, oriented towards invasion of privacy type claims, and whether that was the legislature's intent in enacting the statute, or whether other types of claims can fit under that umbrella as well. So, in essence, what the Lakers are saying here is that because there isn't an express exclusion for TCPA claims, the exclusion for invasion of privacy claims doesn't apply because the underlying suit filed by this fan, Mr. Emanuel, also asserts claims for things like nuisance and violations of other property rights. So the gist of the underlying action isn't solely invasion of privacy in the Lakers' view. And on the other side of that, you've got federal saying that, well, no, the you know, the exclusion in question, you know, will encompass all the claims, you know, filed in the underlying action, and that the you know, the foundation of the TCPA, you know, is based on invasion of privacy. So it's another case that I think could have broad implications. You know, it seems like every day I come across at least three or four decisions in TCPA insurance coverage cases. And
no question about that. We get a lot of those decisions. And, before we leave this one, I don't want to leave with just slamming the Lakers, because their great owner, Jerry Buss, did give us the case that allows insurers under certain circumstances to recoup defense costs for claims that are not even potentially covered. Because of time limitations, I'd like to go through the couple more cases, but just maybe spend a minute or so each on it. The third case on your list is General Refractories versus First State, which is before the Third Circuit. What's the core issue there?
Sure. So the Third Circuit is looking at whether or not a common exclusion for asbestos-related claims in a traveler's surety and casualty company policy is ambiguous, which would render it unenforceable. And this case made my list because of the prevalence of this exclusion. You know, and the lower court here in Pennsylvania ruled that the exclusion was ambiguous and agreed with the policyholder here, General Refractories Company, that it could be reasonably read to only extend or only exclude coverage, rather, for claims related to injuries from exposure to raw asbestos. And here, General Refractories didn't mine raw asbestos, and rather made products containing asbestos. So it's kind of this, you know, it's an esoteric issue, but I think the impact could be huge. You know, the traveler's position here is that there's only one reasonable interpretation of this exclusion, which is that the exclusion applies to claims for injuries from exposure to asbestos in any form, which would include both raw asbestos and asbestos-containing products. So it's another case, you know, that depending on how it comes down, you know, I mean, you've got thousands, you know, maybe even millions of policies out there with this exclusionary language, and I would imagine that, you know, a decision that this exclusion is ambiguous, you know, could expand the exposure that a lot of insurance companies have to asbestos injury claims.
And the fourth case on your watch list for 2017, and I think it's the only trial court decision on your list, is Natural Grocers versus Amco Insurance Company in the District of Colorado. And this is a case, as I understand it, that really deals with the publication requirement to satisfy personal or advertising injury, and the question is whether or not hacking of information by third parties constitutes publication. Right?
Yeah, so this, as you said, this is another data breach case involving a commercial general liability policy. And, you know, at this point, most CGL insurers have started introducing these sweeping data breach exclusions into their policies, but you still have a few of these cases under legacy policies, you know, pending out there. And so the Colorado district court here has an opportunity to weigh in on this ongoing dispute and decide whether the hacking of confidential data by a malicious third party satisfies the publication requirement for personal or advertising injury. And you know, that's an issue that's been critical in these sorts of
cyber claims that we're seeing. And Jeff, the final case is USAA Texas Lloyd versus, I think it's meant Shaka, not sure the pronunciation, that's before the Texas Supreme Court. It's a case that could be interesting depending on what the court says, or it could be really unique to the case because there's an argument to be made that there were inconsistent verdicts unique to this particular matter.
Yeah, and so in this case, so the Texas Supreme Court heard oral arguments in October, and the key question here is whether an insurance company USAA, Texas Lloyd's Company, can be held liable for extra contractual damages for failure to conduct a sufficient investigation of a hurricane damage claim, even though a jury concluded that the carrier didn't breach the policy. So this is an issue that has come up in quite a few cases in Texas that's just reached the Texas Supreme Court. So from the policyholder bar's perspective, you know, if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the policyholder and says that a breach isn't necessary for the recovery of extra contractual damages, you know, that could be a weapon for policyholders, but there's a lot of questions as to whether the Texas Supreme Court would make that sort of broad ruling based on the, you know, as you noted, the unique facts of this case. In the trial court, you've got a state jury finding, you know, that there was no breach of the policy by USAA, and then turning around and finding that the insurance company could be held liable for extra contractual damages. So arguably, one thing that a lot of sources have focused on in my discussions with them about this case is whether the facts of this case will ultimately, you know, make it difficult for the Supreme Court to issue a broad brush ruling, and if it might find that the verdict here was against the weight of the evidence. So, a case that could have broad implications or could be limited to the specific facts. So it'll be another interesting one to watch.
Yeah, I mean, in all the cases you've identified are interesting, and one of the great things about you and Law 360 is to follow developments in these and other cases. We need only follow you. I do have a couple cases I want to mention.
Sure.
For people to take a look at. We don't have time to discuss them. Continental versus Honeywell, the New Jersey Supreme Court granted review in that case on choice of law, and more importantly, the issue of unavailability may be part of the decision because the court will consider whether a policyholder is responsible for periods beyond the period of time when insurance was available based on fundamental principles articulated in Owens, Illinois, such as encouraging proper and responsible conduct, economics, efficiency, pricing of products, simple justice, factors such as those. And the main exceptional circumstance there that the insurers are pointing to is that the policyholder manufactured brake and clutch products without asbestos until 2001, knowing that it faced asbestos lawsuits and knowing it did not have insurance coverage for such claims after 1987. So another interesting case to watch.
Absolutely.
Well, folks, you cannot get this information on Fox News or CNN. The only place you is on Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio and Law 360. And Jeff, we've got some interesting days ahead following these decisions we've been talking about. And also with the Trump administration taking control, there'll be interesting legislative policy and regulatory developments, both nationally and internationally, impacting insurers and financial services companies. And I know that you're going to be following them throughout 2017, correct?
Absolutely.
Well, this was absolutely terrific, and I think we should at least make this an annual event. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us on Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio. We look forward to reading your articles and your updates in Law 360 throughout the year. And we want to thank all of you, our listeners, for joining us. If you have any topics or guest suggestions for future broadcasts, please let us know. We look forward to joining you soon for the next episode of Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Take us home, Royal Oaks.
You've been listening to Hinshaw & Culbertson LLP's Insurance Law Radio. The information contained in this program is provided solely for general informational purposes and does not constitute legal advice. For information on past and upcoming Insurance Law Radio programs, visit the Insurance Services Practice Group page of www.hinshawlaw.com. This is Royal Oaks thanking you for joining us and inviting you to join us for the next episode of Insurance Law Radio.